Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, happy Friday. We're going to close out this week's programming, daily episodes on the Ukraine conflict beyond with an episode about India. I'm speaking with my Hudson Institute colleague, Dr. Aparna Pandey. She's the director of Hudson Institute's initiative on the future of India and South Asia. This conversation is happening because so many different debates and issues in the Ukraine conflict have revolved around a multipolar world, a world where the United States and the West cannot simply call the shots. And if you're looking at how Russia, even China, articulates this conflict, they make clear that the future of the world order is going to be determined by a world where countries have much more autonomy when it comes to making their decisions. One of those countries is India, how India handles the Ukraine conflict, how India handles its rivalry with China, how it handles its positioning in the US and the Indo-Pacific. All this comes together. So it was a real privilege to speak with Dr. Pandey on all these issues. Lots of great stuff here. If you want to learn more about any specific topics and deep dives, be sure to let us know in the comments. And of course, give us any feedback you need. Once again, we're going to do one last week of this upcoming week on these Ukraine topics, and we'll get back to our regular programming after that. So hope you enjoy the episode. Dr. Aparna Pandey, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much, Marshall. Pleasure to be here.
We're going to try to cover as much as possible when it comes to India's foreign policy. But as is clear from both of your books, so much, your two most recent books, so much of this conversation is frankly going into thousands of years of history, if anything. Therefore, we're not going to be perfectly able to cover everything, but just really want to give an introduction here. So let's start with the most basic and zoomed into the news here. How would you describe India's foreign policy positioning and decisions in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
So to understand India's reactions to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you have to understand India's relations with Russia, which go back to the India's historical relationship with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. India's balancing act, as I would call it, has to be understood in the context of Russia being India's historical and ongoing defense supplier. 70% of India's military arsenal is Russian made. About 50% of India's arms imports are from Russia. So you have to understand why India would need to make sure that those spare parts, those supplies don't get stopped or don't get hurt. And in this, please bear in mind that, India's geographical situation. India has China to its north. There's an ongoing border conflict and border dispute. For the last 2 years, Indian and Chinese troops have been on the border since April 2020. And so India needs to make sure that if and when China, Chinese troops again cross the border, India should be able to defend itself, because when India fights with China or has a conflict with China, India is doing it on its own. So India needs to make sure that those military supplies are provided. So that's part of the reason. The other part is, again, the China factor, which is that India would like Russia to keep India's interests in mind, even while Russia is becoming closer to China. And so from Delhi's point of view, the way to ensure that Russia keeps India's interests in mind is to continue to purchase sort of limited military supplies from Russia and some oil. That is how it is seen. Please remember, however, just one final point, Marshall. India-US bilateral trade stands at $146 billion with a B. In US, European Union, UAE are India's top trading partners. India-Russia trade, total trade, stands at $10 billion with a B. So there is no comparison between the two. It's more a question of trying to ensure, there are certain strategic concerns India has.
And I want to get to the historical basis for India and Russia's defense relationship, because I think a good illustration of the 70% figure you listed is that one of India's aircraft carriers is a former Soviet decommissioned aircraft carrier itself. It's a very visceral image there. It has the unique Russian takeoff styling and everything there. But what explains that defense relationship? I mean, I know the US supported Pakistan during the Cold War. Is that where this comes down to? Like, how should we think about it?
There are three factors, I would say. One, and this dates back to India's post-colonial legacy. India was a colonial sort of, you know, India was a, is a post-colonial country, 200 years of British colonial rule. During that time period, all decisions were made by England. They were not made by Indians on for Indian interests. India's economy was basically decimated. And so modern India decided that India needs, that they, that it needs to rebuild India's economy and ensure that no foreign country or no foreign company or corporation ever rules over the Indian market. And so there's a very strong sense of autonomy or self-sufficiency or domestic industrial base, whether civilian or military. And that explains the strong Soviet slash Russian legacy. During the Cold War, India asked both the Soviet Union and the West Soviet bloc and the Western bloc to help it build its civilian industrial base and military industrial base. Western corporations were not keen to do so. They did not want to share technology or build, operate, and transfer because of royalty, patents, and desire that countries purchase rather than manufacture locally. The Soviet Union was willing to help set up India's civilian and military industrial base. And that's where the legacy comes. So it's not just the aircraft carriers. Most of India's Indian Air Force fleet is Sukhoi or MiGs. There are a few Rafales from France and there are a few Mirage from France, but that's all. And that dates back to the fact that India wants, India understands that to be a global or a great power, you need your own, you need a domestic defense base and a domestic economic base. And Western corporations were reluctant to do that.
And this is interesting because to that then, a key part of the story you're telling, especially in making India great, is the reality of India's economic growth, its positioning on the global level. Yet there is this deep dependence on a Russian arms industry. How has India gone about diversifying? Because once again, China went through this dynamic on their own as well too. So what's the state of India's future facing defense policy when it comes to manufacturing and procurement?
So what I had laid out was what India has wanted. Unfortunately, India has not been able to achieve a lot of it of what it wanted. And that comes to answering this part of your question, which is that, yes, China had the same problem. China actually managed to build its civilian and its defense base. I mean, I would not even cite China. I would cite South Korea. In the 1950s, both India and South Korea purchased submarines. Today, South Korea is one of the countries which may sell India submarines. The problem India has had in building, especially its defense industrial base, is that India in the Indian state and the Indian foreign and security policy establishment, unfortunately, has never viewed defense as as needing or requiring long-term planning. Now, most countries around the world, United States, China, European countries even, for them, defense, it includes something like 20 years or 40 years out, right? You see who's your competitor, how is technology going to change? So you talk about upgrading technology, maybe slimming down the workforce, planning for future threats. In India, defense has primarily been an ad hoc status quo. So when there's a threat, you respond to it. Defense has never been given the resources, the long-term planning, and that strategic overlook which it requires. And that is the reason why 75 years after independence, India still does not have a defense industrial base by which it can manufacture most of its requirements, and it remains dependent on Russia. So what has changed in the last two decades is that United States, never sold to India. But US is one of India's top suppliers today. It is Russia, United States, Israel, and France, who are the four top suppliers to India. But India has not invested. I mean, there's a good book which came out almost a decade or so ago. It's called Arming Without Aiming. And it explains India's predicament. Marshall, if you want to go somewhere, you need to decide where you are going and you need to plan for it. India has unfortunately not been good at planning. And so, you know, defense requires planning. Building hard power requires planning. You know, sort of almost every area requires planning, and planning and implementing has been very difficult for the Indian state.
So taking us to the Ukraine crisis specifically, there has been, as an outside observer, what I think I could categorize as frustration with the Indian position. And this frustration is driven by, and I get to this in a latter question, but I'll set it up here, by the contradictions in the West's relationship to India. So once again, the world's largest democracy, much cultural alignment in a bunch of different ways. Yet it very much feels like India's outside the Western camp without being an opponent, without being anything negative, but it's very much, you should be a part of this, yet you're not a part of this. What decisions, and we'll get to the dynamics there in a second, but what specific decisions or lack of decisions has India made the past month that have driven this frustration?
I would say a lot of this has to do with the widespread belief, or I would say hyped expectations over the last decade, that since India is part of the Asia-Pacific, pivot to Asia, Indo-Pacific policy, and agrees with the United States and American partners, I won't even say West, I'll say American partners in Asia and other parts of the world. Therefore, India's vision of every part of the world aligns with that of the American partners. And that's where the problem comes. India, and this sort of, you know, this is something which is consistent throughout India's foreign policy for the last 75 years. India makes decisions based on geography, its national interests, and which part of the world you're talking about. When it comes to the Indo-Pacific, India's sort of vision of the security architecture of Indo-Pacific aligns with the United States and American partners. However, that's the maritime Asia that you're talking about. India's concerns, sort of Indo-Pacific from India's perspective, does not cover the continental Asian landmass. Indo-Pacific maritime security does not cover India-China on the India-China undemarcated border. It does not cover India-Pakistan. It does not cover the Middle East. And so India's perception, so India and United States and their partners do not align on how they view Russia, how they view Central Asia, how they view the Middle East. That's where the frustration is, the presumption that because you agree with me on X, you agree with me on A through Z. And India's argument is, I agree with you on 10 in the alphabet. But because of my geography and my historical considerations and my security imperatives, I will disagree with you on many of the others. But that's what friends do. We don't align on everything.
So I want to get to the specific relationships at hand here. So you already did a great job of describing the dynamics driving the Russia relationship. So the military industrial, but also the need to intercept with the China side of things. Let's just specifically ask about a couple of relationships. So one, how would you define India's relationship with the United States? And how would you say that relationship has or hasn't changed given the new Biden administration? Because it seems as if, once again, as an outside observer, that the Modi government and the Trump administration were very aligned, rallies, obviously that's popular politics, but there seemed to be something there. How would you say the state of that relationship is today?
So I would say the sort of, I'm sure you and I both saw when Prime Minister Modi came for the in-person Quad Leaders Summit, it looked as though President Biden was going to hug him. And if it wasn't for COVID, that would have happened. It was a very warm welcome to Prime Minister Modi in the White House. So sort of the last two decades, almost 22 years, and I date this back to President Clinton's visit to India in March 2000, which really changed or transformed the India-US relationship. But basically, every American president since sort of, you know, since 1999, 2000, I would say, has visited India, has had a good relationship, has spoken about India as a natural ally, a natural partner, the partnership of the 21st century, a country we would like as a great power, and a country which sort of, you know, the U, which is critical for US interests and aligns with US on values and every other area. And the same thing with every Indian prime minister going back 22 years. So I'd say the last two decades have transformed the relationship. And it does not really matter whether it's a Republican president or a Democrat president. It doesn't matter who that incumbent is. Similarly, it doesn't matter whether it is a BJP prime minister or a Congress prime minister or a coalition prime minister in India. Sort of both sides understand that the partnership or the relationship with the other country is the defining and is the critical relationship in the economic arena, defense arena, strategic, any other. However, as happens with friends, there will be areas in which you disagree. And so there are certain areas where the two countries will disagree, whether it's because of domestic compulsions, whether it's because of, you know, sort of differences in how, you know, the economic systems are and how, you know, sort of India is still a developing country at some level. The United States is not. And so there are, and then the geographical, but it is India's most important relationship. And sort of, you know, Delhi understands that.
So the next question, and this actually gets to something you hinted at when you separated America's Pacific partners from the quote unquote West. How would you describe the Indian relationship to, let's say, Western Europe? So not merely just the UK, which is obviously complicated by colonialism, but France, there's a bit of a defense relationship there. How would you characterize Europe's relation to India?
Actually, India has sort of, you know, France is one of India's closest partners. You know, sort of India has a good relationship with Europe, including UK, despite the colonial legacy and all of, I mean, and the sort of, you know, the civilizational issues. It's a strong economic partnership. It's a strong, especially with France, it's a strong defense partnership. And in sort of, you know, in some sort of France is in at many levels what Russia or what Soviet Union used to be to India in the Cold War. France. So to remember one aspect of why Indians have a sentimental view of Russia or the Indian strategic elite does is during the Cold War, India needed a partner on the UN Security Council who had a veto. The United States and United Kingdom used to side with Pakistan, for example, on Kashmir. At that time, Soviet Union would veto any resolution on Kashmir, which India did not view as in its favor. In the last since the 1990s, it's France which has started to do that for India. France is India's strongest supporter on the, of the veto of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. France sort of, you know, has a very similar view to India on nationalism, you know, sort of there is a strong belief in French and, you know, French nationalism, cultural, civilizational, on issues like nuclear. You know, France in the 1970s and 1990s was that one Western country which did not impose sanctions on India. France has sold sort of, you know, India sort of military equipment and also sort of been on sort of, you know, agreed to transfer technology. So France is one of India's closest strategic partners. I mean, India has good relations with sort of, you know, with the European countries, Germany, you know, sort of Belgium. So it's a good partnership. And in the maritime domain, again, France and India, because of the French former colonies and some territories in the Indian and the Pacific Ocean, France has been one of those countries which has sort of, you know, sort of closely aligned with India in certain parts of the Indian Ocean and the Indo-Pacific.
Let's speak to bad relationships. China, like, what is the, what, how would you sum up the relationship between India and China, which it doesn't, I guess, once again, my stake here as a interested outside observer, the conflicts that occur don't seem optimal for either side, given their positions, given the issues that are up for debate right now. What is the state of that relationship?
The state of that relationship is, I would say, is at its lowest, barring maybe 1962, 61, 62. 62, India-China fought their last war, which India lost. But the state of relationship is almost as bad as, I would say, the late 1950s. And being as objective as I can, I would say a lot of that falls on China. And the reason is, so the two countries are also civilizations. The two countries have a very long border. It's about 2,167 miles long border. Most of it is undemarcated. Most of it is high up in the mountain ranges. Since the 90s, there are other issues as well. So there's Tibet, there's China's, increasing penetration into a region India refers to as its sphere of influence, which is South Asia, Indian Ocean. But purely coming to the border dispute between India and China, from the 1990s, the two countries signed a border agreement and basically said that we would keep this on the back burner, we would build ties, and we would even if it doesn't resolve, we can at least have a normal relationship. That is why China is one of India's top trading partners, because the economic relationship really boosted. But from the for the last, I would say, 8 years or 9 years, basically since President Xi took over, at repeated intervals, the Chinese PLA has encroached on some part of this undemarcated and some part of the territory which has been with India for decades. And taken over territory basically in a two steps forward, zero step back position. In previous occasions, India has said, okay, let's have a conversation, let's have a dialogue. Both sides should move back. India moved back, China did not. When the latest round started 2 years ago, India decided that this time we will not go back unless the Chinese troops go back from every position along the border. And so there's been a stalemate for 2 years because even the Chinese foreign minister was in India just today, was in Delhi today to talk about the border issue. But from China's point of view, China wants India to move on and forget what China has taken over the last 2 years ago. And India says, unless you actually move back from certain positions and go back to status quo ante, or at least some part of status quo ante, we are not going to move on. We are not going to forget about it. So I see it as President Xi's desire to ensure that before the party Congress, which is this year, he can tell the Chinese people that he has managed to get back certain territories. He has restored China's prestige in the world. That includes what he did in Hong Kong, what he would like to do in Taiwan, the South China Sea. And you must bear in mind, Marshall, China, according to Chinese maps, if you look at the Indian map, China lays claim to all of Ladakh, which is one third of an Indian state, all of Sikkim, which is an Indian state, and the entire Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh. Chinese maps claim all of that is Chinese territory. By default of the fact that many centuries ago, some parts of that region of those territories used to be part of the Tibetan empire or Tibetan kingdom. And so it's basically a dispute between a country which is status quo oriented like India, which said we inherited borders. They may not have been ideal, but we don't believe in revisionism. We will deal with the cards that we have been dealt with. And a country like China, which believes no, it's a revisionist, revanchist regime, which believes that it needs to take back every territory it believes the Middle Kingdom ever had centuries ago.
I'm so glad you introduced that status quo revanchist frame, because it gets to a question I had a little later on that I'll just raise here. you obviously remember this discourse, but this was just when I was just much younger. You'd read about this in, you know, high school or something, this idea of the BRICS. So Brazil, Russia, India, China, then South Africa. There was this rising set of powers in this post-Cold War era that sought to challenge the power structures of this very Western-oriented post-colonial, post-Cold War bit. And one among, separate from the lack of economic performance and South Africa and Brazil's difficulties, part of the reason why this framework doesn't seem to be particularly useful is actually within the BRICS, there's actually a large amount of disagreement. So I would say specifically Russia and China are these revanchist, revisionist powers that you were describing. Putin specifically, when he's articulating this crisis in his invasion of Ukraine, is saying, I am challenging this unfair Western order. Once again, bring in more of this multipolar discourse. How does India think about the multipolar discourse? Because it's very interesting, right? Because on one hand, independence, autonomy, that would be something we would push India towards. We want this multipolar order. We think the status quo isn't fair. But on the other hand, as you just articulated, when Russia and China speak of this multipolar non-Western order, they are basically arguing that they will have more ability to advance their own interests that in much ways are against the status quo. So how does India just conceive this remaking of the world order? Because it's, and from both angles, you see competing, I think, desires, I'd say.
So India's foreign policy at its core would like a multipolar world order, because the belief is that India, with its limited economic and military capabilities, can only play a role on the global stage when there is a multipolar world order, of which India is one of the poles, because there's a strong belief within Indians, both the general public and the Indian leaders, that India is a global power or a great power and deserves to be on the global high table. Now, the reasons why it wants to will differ from those of other countries. Most countries will say, it's economic and military power. So, you know, I don't need population. I just need hard power. India's view is different. But India is a status quo oriented power. India does not want to change the global world order by force to ensure a multipolar world order. India presumes that there will be a multipolar world order because that is what will be suitable for the world. So it's not that it is that, like Russia and China, it would like to change by force and create a multipolar world order. It believes that that is the default order for the world. Where India would like changes would be, for example, the economic arena. And this is partly because of being a developing country or a post-colonial country. So in institutions like the World Bank and IMF, for decades, India was one of those which said, you need to give more power to countries which are developing countries. Only developed countries should not make decisions for the rest of the world. On the United Nations Security Council, similarly, India, but along with Japan and Germany and Brazil, feel that there should be just those five countries which were the victors after the World War II, should not remain the five countries on the veto holding five permanent members of UN Security Council. It should be broadened to include more countries which are economic powerhouses or by population size deserve to be there. But it's not a desire that, okay, if tomorrow UN Security Council doesn't change, India will withdraw from the UN. So it's a desire for a change, but the belief that the change is something which is required and necessary and will happen as long as you keep pushing and and bring about that incremental change. That is how India views, you know, sort of the multipolar world, or but sort of as a country which doesn't like chaos, doesn't like wars, doesn't like conflict. It doesn't want something which is done through revolution or chaos. It wants a gradual recognition and a gradual transformation to what it believes should be the world order.
And to just editorialize for a second, what's comforting about what you're describing is it does not seem that in your characterization, India is driven by anxiety.
No, not at all.
Russia and China, in both their cases, are driven by an anxiety. And it seems like if you're looking at a potential Taiwan crisis, if you're looking at the literal disaster that's happening in Ukraine, both these current and potential problems will be driven by, we only have X amount of time. We have X. So I think that's just a comforting thing I'm taking from this. So for the next question, your most recent book, Making India
Marshall,
Great.
Do you mind if I just add one quick line here? I agree, it's not. And the reason is because almost everything India does at its core is the belief that we are a 5,000-year-old continuous civilization. We have been there, we are here, and we will remain. So in modern India still occupies the majority of the Indian subcontinent, which was where India has been for centuries. So India does not believe that it can be taken over, it can be wiped out, or things will so drastically change that it needs to worry now. Sort of, you can say it's borderline, the difference between being status quo oriented and complacent. But from India's point of view, it's a belief that there is no sort of existential threat to Indian existence that India needs to go revisionist or revanchist.
Yeah, I'm glad you followed up there because I want to focus on this for a second. It's funny, before recording started, this is me speaking to the audience. You pointed out that there's no way we're going to get through everything here. And this is an example why there's a million things to hear, but I really want to hit this point. To your 5,000 year civilization point, you're not a sinologist, so I'm not expecting the perfect answer on this, but China is also a 5,000 year old civilization as well too. China, and this is what my actual question is, China's relationship, even with colonialism, feels different. So horrific things happened to India during colonialism. I don't need to tell you that, obviously, but you don't have the same frame of like the centuries of humiliation, which is the Chinese phrasing, that specifically seems to drive the revanchism, the inadequacy, the aggression, frankly. I'm just curious. Why does that not happen on the Indian side? Because I don't want to just get orientalist, because it's very easy to, you know, just get orientalist about it. But just what just explains, because once again, most of the colonialism, it's happening on the same period. India is broken up in many respects. You have, it's just what explains the difference between these two civilizations and how they handled their reaction to colonialism?
So sort of, you know, some of it has to do with, so you have to bear in mind that when you look at China, and I'm speaking as a non-sinologist, you know, Chinese empires by and large, you know, sort of managed to resist conquest invasions from outside, except for the Mongols who were then absorbed. By and large, the Chinese empires expanded and, you know, sort of, it was only the Mongols who took over and then were absorbed and later on the colonial past. But the colonial past came in and took part. China was never fully colonized. You know, it was, some parts were taken over from the Opium War onwards, all of that. But there was sort of, you know, there was a view of the barbarian, the view of the outsider, the view of, you know, China sort of, you know, going through all these centuries of humiliation. India has been a very different civilization in the sense that over the 5,000 plus years, different kingdoms, different empires, and different influences came. So, you know, there were empires whose origins are in what is present-day Afghanistan. So there were the Afghan influence, the Persian influence, there was the Turkish influence, there was the Mongol influence, then there was the British. And so different empires came. And so, and again, how civilizations view it. Hindu civilization, by and large, is an inclusive civilization. There's a view that, you know, differences enrich you rather than, you know, sort of you resist differences. So Indian civilization today is an amalgamation of all those influences which came over centuries. So the Indian reaction to colonialism comes out in India's foreign policy in the sense that India wants autonomy in decision-making. wants to ensure that, you know, any decisions Delhi takes is because they are India's interest, not because, you know, Tokyo or Washington or Brussels or London would like India to make them. So there's a very strong streak of independence and principled independence or decision making. Second, it comes in the arena of economics, where India would like to build its, make in India, build its economy, because it doesn't want to be dependent on foreigners, or doesn't want, you know, the ship following the boat or the flag following the boat. And so sort of, you know, doesn't want India's economy to be wiped out again. And in the military arena, where India wants to be independent, but it doesn't come in the, there is no sort of, you know, knee jerk, you know, we don't want to be part of the world, or knee jerk that we have to fight, you know, every foreigner. Now, I would put a caveat here, and that is that they sort of, you know, there has been, you know, there have been two strands over the centuries on sort of, or let's say two contending visions of what India and the idea of India is, just as in every other country, just as in this country. You know, what is America? Who is American? You know, what is citizenship? And so, you know, sort of that, there, that sort of, that conflation of, you know, sort of, is it, so these two strands remained through centuries, remained in the national struggle, and have existed to this day. There are those who believe, as I described, that India is an inclusive civilization. And as the Indian constitution lays out, it is sovereign, secular, you know, democratic, plural. And if you're born in India, you're an Indian. Doesn't matter where your ancestors came from. And then there are those who believe that India is about 80-81% Hindu, and therefore it's a Hindu majority country, and it should be a Hindu majority state. And so sort of, you know, there are those social pulls there. There are people who have, you know, a view that India should not be this inclusive, and should, there should be an, you know, there are those who say Indians should not speak English. There are those who say they should speak Hindi. You know, sort of, they should not dress in, you know, in Western attire. It is there, but sort of that conflict remains. And, you know, as of now, it's still a back and forth. I hope my long answer explains what what you asked.
No, it's good. And I accidentally muted myself. I was just adding, I'm really happy that you mentioned that it's complicated in terms of India, because we're doing in an hour this explanation. And if we tried to do an episode around what is America, that would obviously take, that could be an entire podcast on its in of itself, like beyond just one episode. So I appreciate the nuance you're giving here. So there's been a consistent theme throughout this episode that I want to make very explicit, which is, and I'll just ask this question directly, is India a superpower? Because you've kind of hinted at economic underperformance. I think the way that a just Western consumer, like let's say someone who reads The Economist or something like that, would say is India is always the future, just next year. I think that's really just what I genuinely, like, I grew up with like Economist covers in my house growing up. And I actually think I could literally see, like, I didn't actually read them, but I just think of a cover, 2003, that style of rhetoric would always be there. So just please speak to, I don't want to say false promise of India, because it's real promise, but I think speak to the maybe under, I don't want to be rude, but underperformance may be the right word to use there without being pejorative, but just speak to that.
Yeah. So sort of, you know, it's two ways of looking at this question. If you want to ask, do Indians believe that is India a superpower or a great power? Yes. The majority of Indians and most Indian leaders believe India is a great power and is a global power. And that India deserves to be on the global high table. But that's because for the majority of Indians, India's claim to global power or great powerdom comes from its civilization, its democracy, its soft power, everything from yoga to Bollywood, you know, its economic potential, its military potential, and its location, geostrategic location. So we believe we are a superpower already. It's just the world needs to recognize it and give us what is our due. What is ignored, however, is that by all, you know, sort of possible rankings and indices, India is not a great power. A great power means your peers need to recognize you as one, and great power requires economic power and hard power. You need to be, I need to be able to convince Marshall to do something without having to go to war with Marshall. That proves that I'm a great power. My presumption that I'm a great power doesn't make Marshall agree that I'm a great power or accept me as one. And India has multitude challenges, which the state has basically not been able to resolve. First is what I described earlier, the struggle between two ideas of India. What is India? And the more there is a struggle within, the more it creates a challenge for how the world looks at India. So, you know, India may want to be viewed as a global power, but if the rest of the world sees modern India, 75 years after independence, going back to rewrite history and, you know, sort of rectify wrongs of 1,000 years ago, that is not how global powers are supposed to behave. You look forward, you know, sort of look ahead. You don't look back to rewrite wrongs. That's not what a global power does. And so sort of this social conflict, religious conflict will hurt any chances India has of global power. Second, India has huge population, tremendous demographic potential. Majority of Indians are around 25 years of age, 500 million labor force, but less than 22% of women are part of that labor force. You can't have half your population out of the labor force. You know, sort of India is one of those countries which did not really invest in primary healthcare or primary education. Tertiary, yes, we have great universities, but not primary level. So you don't have a basic skilled workforce. For most of the world, about 60% of their labor is skilled. India, 7 to 8% is skilled. Doesn't really help because you need to move workers away from agriculture to manufacturing and services. But without basic skills, you can't really do anything with them. India's economic structure. India's sort of, you know, and sort of, you know, many Indians hate me for saying this, but there's a cultural problem with India's, with how India and in sort of Indian state views economics. It's biased. The Indian state and the Indian economic outlook is biased against wealth generation. Wealth generation basically came because of a certain philosophical outlook in the West, you know, sort of reformation, renaissance, you know, a bourgeoisie which pushed back against the state. You force certain sort of, you know, certain environment which helps wealth generation. In India, partly cultural problem is that India's culture and civilization does not value wealth generation. Rather, we have a culture where talking about being wealthy or making money is looked down upon. Second, the modern Indian state and the way India, you know, India is one of those countries where democracy preceded capitalism. So you have a modern democratic state, which means you need to redistribute wealth where the majority is poor, but you are redistributing before you are making money. So it creates a challenge for, you know, for industrial development. It creates a challenge for actually growing the economy, because how do you redistribute unless you actually grow? And so you don't have sort of, you know, strong free market or a capitalist institutions, and the government has a very paternalistic view and doesn't sort of, you know, and so India's economy has at time periods grown very fast. I mean, from 1947 to, you know, almost from the 1990s, it ranged between 1 to 2 to 3% of growth. In 1990s, India implemented economic reforms. And so for a decade, we had 8 to 10%, but we are back down again because sort of we've still not sort of understood the importance of unleashing the market. There's a reluctance to do that. Finally, And I mentioned this a little earlier when you asked about defense and military. India has a large military if you go by numbers, personnel and equipment. But large military is not a great power military. Unless you invest in resources, unless you invest in upgradation. So for example, if 70% is Russian military equipment, how up to date is it? If about 68-67% is old and needs to be replaced, then how upgraded is your military? If you don't plan for 20 years out or 40 years out, then very soon you'll have equipment which cannot be used. And we are seeing this in the Russia-Ukraine crisis. A lot of Russian military equipment is not up to date and upgraded. And so if India wants to be a great power, it needs to upgrade and update its military. And that modernization hasn't really happened.
So the next question would be, the undercurrent of this entire conversation has been India's post-colonial, post-1947 foreign policy, especially during the Cold War. And as it seems very clear that on two fronts now we are entering into a second Cold War, this history is even more necessary than before. So I would just love for you, and feel free, you know, we're nearing the end here, so go as long as you need to go. And this is hard to sum up perfectly, but just give us an overview of India's post-colonial self-conception, leader of the second world, neutrality, just as effectively as you can convey that.
So most countries' foreign policies are framed, you know, sort of based on how they view themselves and how they view their place in the world. You know, the United States has a certain conception of itself, a city on the hill. There's a belief that, you know, you came on the world stage, you were reluctant. And then, you know, there are certain core principles. Same thing for India. By and large, India's foreign policy has remained the same for the last 75 years. And there are certain core principles. First is, as I mentioned earlier, as a 5,000-year-old civilization, India's view is that India was a great civilization and India will be a great power. It just needs to wait for the world to accept and recognize it. But India's conception of power is different. India does not believe that India needs to become a security provider for other countries. India does not believe that it needs to use its economic or its military might to change because it's a status quo power, so it doesn't believe in changing things. So yes, India does believe it is the hegemon in South Asia and the Indian Ocean region. So when it comes to its other neighbors in South Asia, India does act as the security provider. But beyond the South Asian or the Indian subcontinent, India sort of views itself as one of the many countries which would be happy to provide, you know, assistance. But it doesn't view itself as a security provider. It doesn't believe in military aid being aid. India views aid as developmental, human assistance, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, things like that. Second, autonomy and independence in decision-making is critical for India. As a post-colonial country, as a country for and sort of 200 years of colonial rule, it could not make its decisions on its own. So that influences how India looks at how India looked at the Cold War period, during which India did not want to be part of a bloc, but India wanted good relations with both blocs. So it followed policies where it would follow issue-based agreement or disagreement. So agree with the Western bloc on this issue, on the Soviet bloc on this issue, you know, have economic relations with both. And also, in some ways, India felt that this helped India do what it has always believed it should, which is be an example or a guide to the developing part of the world, or the third world, as it was called. So the non-aligned movement in many ways encompassed a very large part of the developing post-colonial world. Countries which did not want to be in either bloc wanted benefits from both, and so therefore stayed non-aligned. Not neutral, as Secretary Dulles used to call India, but non-aligned, which is that issue-based sort of alignment. This changed at the end of the Cold War and the sort of post-Cold War era into what India calls strategic autonomy, which is again, India's decisions are strategically autonomous. I will agree with Marshall on this issue, but I will disagree with Marshall on this issue. Doesn't mean that I don't have a strong friendship with Marshall. It is just that I believe I need to make decisions based on my interests, and that desire for autonomy and independence still remains very strong. Third, in economic foreign policy or in defense acquisitions, this desire for autonomy and independence remains. So I would like countries to help me build my economy, foreign investment, capital, technology, but bearing in mind my colonial legacy, post-colonial legacy, I would like to build my economy. I would like to make in India, strengthen India's economy. And so if you are a true partner and friend, please help me build my economy and my industry, defense industry, because it will be to your interest if I'm a stronger economic and military power. Next, sort of following along the lines of autonomy and independence, India has always been reluctant to join any open security or military alliance. So India never joined NATO. India has been reluctant for any Asian NATO. Just like there are people who call, the Chinese refer to Quad as an Asian NATO, which it isn't. India.
Could you actually explain, we mentioned the Quad. Can you actually just explain what the Quad is?
Sure. So the Quad sort of, you know, is basic. It translates into the quadrilateral dialogue. It's India, United States, Japan, and Australia. Its origins are about a decade or 12 years old. And the basic sort of, you know, the way I look at it, it is a way to draw India into playing a bigger role in the Indian Ocean and Indo-Pacific region, and sort of bring about collaboration between three countries with whom India has a strong economic and defense partnership in a region which, you know, sort of as former Prime Minister, Japanese Prime Minister Abe used to say, the confluence of oceans and a diamond. So the four countries in the four corners which can collaborate and work together. Now, I believe it's a good organization because it forces India to do things India would not necessarily do on its own. The challenge the Quad faces is, and this is me being a realist, that at the end of the day, unless you put some hard power into a relationship, it doesn't really send the message that you want to send, which is to China, that here we are coming together. If Quad does not have a security, intelligence, or military, or even economic dimension, it doesn't really send a message to China. But, you know, sort of Quad has lasted for a sort of more, sort of, you know, almost a few years. It's become something more than just foreign ministers meeting. There's a Quad leaders summit. But let's see if they are able to add some teeth to it and some institutional architecture to it. The reason why I say it doesn't have hard power is the same four countries also are part of the Malabar exercises. But Quad is separate from Malabar. And that leads to what I was saying is that India is reluctant to be part of any security alliance, just as we don't want to be called an ally, right? We want to be called a friend, partner, BFF, any of those you can use, best friend. But we don't want to be called an ally because for us, an ally or alliance means a security. And here, India is reluctant to join a military or security alliance where it will be forced to give up autonomy and independence in decision-making. Sort of this is also why, for example, India does not send its military outside its territory, except under UN peacekeeping missions. So India, you know, has never sent it in any of the Gulf wars or to Afghanistan or anywhere else, because India does not sort of, you know, it's that post-colonial legacy that we don't send the Indian military to other countries. But part of UN peacekeeping, that's fine. That's part of India's, you know, sort of duty to the global community and United Nations. And sort of finally, India's foreign policy has a very strong geographical dimension to it. India sort of, you know, Indians believe we are a global and a great power, but India's first and primary security interests remain the Indian subcontinent and South Asia. So what happens in India's neighbors is paramount for India's security considerations, whether it's Nepal, it's Bangladesh, it's Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Bhutan, they are critical. So anything happening in South Asia is of first and primary importance to India. And then it goes outwards. You know, it'll become Central Asia, Middle East, Southeast Asia, and then beyond. So India's sort of way of looking at the world is from inside out. And so the neighbors are important, and then the other security considerations beyond that. Thank you.
Yeah, and actually, I just have a quick follow-up to this before we wrap. The question would be, the persistent, and everyone's this metaphor actually seems a cliche here, but the elephant in the room when it comes to the U.S.-Indian relationship has been the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. This seems particularly relevant given that post-U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, especially as the role of the ISI, so this is the Pakistani Intelligence Service, especially as the consensus seems pretty clear that the Pakistanis were not just bad allies in that conflict, but were actively serving a harmful role. It seems that there are unsettled questions when it comes to the U.S.'s relationship with Pakistan, especially as it pivots away from Afghanistan itself. What does this mean for the, how does India think of just this that dynamic, basically the closing of that chapter?
So actually, sort of India plays a big role, if not a critical role, in how Pakistan views Afghanistan. And that's something which has been very sort of, you know, most Americans haven't really understood that. Why would India care? Why would Pakistan care about India and Afghanistan? But sort of put yourself in Pakistan's shoes. You are a country which has no history, right? There was no Pakistan before 1947. There's always been an Indian civilization, even if there was no modern India. What is Pakistani territory was part of either historically Afghan empires or Indian empires or the British Indian Empire. And the word Pakistan is an acronym for the states, the provinces which form Pakistan. Punjab, Afghania for the Pashtun area, K for Kashmir, and then Sindh and Baluchistan. So it was basically the land of the pure and an acronym for the provinces. So a country formed in 1947, which has no civilizational background, which has no identity, whose only sort of nationalism is we are not India. We are not, you know, sort of, and we are Muslim, or if you are Muslim India, then why weren't we part of India? And if we are not India, then what are we? And so if you look at Pakistan's geography, you know, on the one hand, sorry.
No worries.
The dilemmas of, you know, having sort of multiple gadgets. So if you look at Pakistan's geography, on one hand, you have India. On the other side, you have Afghanistan, right? All of Pakistan's ethnicities are similar to both its neighbors. So there's a Punjab in India, Punjab in Pakistan. There's a Sindh, there's a Rajasthan. There are Pashtuns in Pakistan, Pashtuns in Afghanistan. There are Baloch in Pakistan, there are Baloch in Afghanistan and Iran. So you are a crafted or a constructed state with no history or civilization, which doesn't belong to your neighbors, both of whom have sort of shared ethnic or linguistic characteristics with you and have older national identities. And to top it, India and Afghanistan have had very good relations since 1947 with the sort of the only times India has not had relations with Kabul is when the Taliban were in power. Mm-hmm. So a paranoid Pakistani military security establishment, which believes that India's foreign policy seeks to undo partition and take back Pakistan into India, believes that in India, which has good relations with Afghanistan, there will be a pincer movement or strategic encirclement, and each country will take over or break up Pakistan. Now you understand why Pakistan supported the Mujahideen in the 1970s and 80s, because from Pakistan's point of view, the only Afghan government which will be pro-Pakistan is one that will be anti-India, which means it has to be an Islamist Pashtun government. The Mujahideen, the Taliban, not a secular or not a nationalist Afghan government, but an Islamist Afghan Pashtun government. Does it make sense?
It does. No, it really, I'm not going to endorse those choices, but to your frame, it makes sense as a specific perspective when you're looking at this. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining. We actually got to 80, 90% of my questions. So thank you for getting the timing right and all that. But yeah, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Marshall. It was a pleasure.